So we're talking about some of the details of, in meditation practice. Last week, I talked about how when we're sitting and distracting thought comes in or obsessive thought, one of the ways, especially when thoughts are repetitive or forceful in a certain way, that they very, very often have what we could think of as either an emotional component behind them that you can tune into, or that you can think of them as a kind of activation in the nervous system, some aspect of fight, flight, or freeze kicking in to the system, and then manifesting as both the emotions associated with those qualities, or as as thought, image, story, etc., and as thought, image, and story. So essentially, the practice that we talked about last week then with that was a kind of inquiry practice where like something arises for us while we're sitting, and rather than just being like, you know, batting it away or trying to just focus, we tune into it, drop into it a layer, as it were, and feel the force or the energy or the emotion or the charge, really, that's beneath it. So, you know, one of my great distractions, very repetitive distractions when I was early in my practice, in my mid-20s, so 20-some years ago now, if we're gonna talk about age, was an obsession with designing the perfect straw bale house that I would live in on a lovely piece of land somewhere near running water, with running water. And I just did it over and over, endless sittings in the Zen Center. Like, you know, the walls should be like this. No, the windows should be here. It should be, the ground floor should have a temple space and then the living space upstairs, and it's shaped like this, and I'll put the deck here, and then, you know, you have to make sure the windows are like this and the entry. And for years I did this. And only like after a long time, essentially I got kind of like, come on. I got a little like, wow, I'm just spending thousands of dollars and endless day and hours of my life just sitting here doing this, pretending to be meditating. And I was like, what is really happening here? And I just like dropped into the feeling of it rather than the story, the narrative. And I was like, oh, I feel unsafe and lost in the world and I want a home. And I was like, oh, haha, sweetie, that's all it was. Just that. And as soon as I felt that, I was doing a whole different thing, right? I was actually embedded in my process. And as soon as I felt that and connected with that as what was underneath that long obsessive habit, essentially, it stopped happening. Like, I didn't need to, it wasn't about designing the perfect house. I like houses, but it was about, like, my system was trying to tell me something, and I had to actually listen. So that practice is a kind of inquiry practice. We would say it's a type of vipassana. And as such, it's going toward deepening understanding in part. And then to the extent that it actually helps those thoughts to subside and the mind to steady, which is what we'll talk about tonight a little bit more, then it also supports then like concentration and stability. So here's a text from the Pali Canon. I haven't done a lot of reading directly from texts lately in here, but I like it. I'll do more of it. Maybe this year we'll read a bunch of suttas. This is a sutta or discourse called the Vitakka Santana Sutta, the removal of distracting thoughts. And it's from the great compilation of Buddhist discourses called the Middle-Length Discourses, the Majjhima Nikaya. And it's a beautiful short text. And I'll read bits of it and give a little commentary so you get a bit the flavor of the text. And then we'll talk about kind of where it's going. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sawati in Jetta's grove and not to Pindaka's park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, venerable sir," they replied. So, I won't say too much about the opening. This is the standard opening. The phrase, "thus have I heard," in the early texts, means that what we are hearing is the oral tradition reporting what the Buddha said, and it's in the voice of the Buddha's cousin and attendant, Ananda, who memorized every teaching the Buddha ever gave and then recited them back verbatim after the Buddha's death at the first council of the elders in the tradition. And so all of the texts start with or imply this opening sentence, "thus have I heard." And then the text gives the location of the discourse. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sawati. This is a town near the banks of the Ganga in North India, in Jetta's Grove, Anathapindika's park. Jetta's Grove means it's on a piece of land that was sold to the monks by a wealthy ruler named Prince Jetta, and Anathapindika is the lay supporter, the patron, the very wealthy patron who bought the land to build the monastery on, and who was the Buddha's perhaps most prominent supporter for his whole life. And the Buddha lived at this monastery that they built for him more than he lived any other place in his teaching career. He lived kind of 20-some years of his life there. So the Buddha's there with the monks called bhikkhus. And so the Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is pursuing the higher mind, from time to time he should give attention to 5 signs." What are the 5? So the higher mind is the mind that is profoundly concentrated in what's called jhana or samadhi in general. Very gathered, stabilized, collected attention that can be used then for the process of inquiry in a very powerful way and the development of wisdom, which is why it's called higher. From time to time, he's speaking to the men at the moment at the monastery. Other times he's speaking both to the monks and nuns. Other times to the whole, what's called the fourfold sangha, which is monks and nuns and men and women lay people. So in this case, it's in the masculine gender because he's talking to the monks. From time to time, he should give attention to 5 signs. And the word sign is complex. The Pali word is nimitta. And I think a simple way to think about it really is like object of meditation or particular thing that you would focus on. So some of the early what do I want to say about that? I'm not going to say too much about nimitta. It becomes really important later on in concentration practice. But in this text, it really just means like there's 5 particular things that you can focus on or ways to focus the mind. And what it means in this text is actually that when you are practicing and you're trying to focus on something and you get distracted, here are 5 ways that you can remove the distracting thought, basically. So here's how the language in the text goes. And listening to this, if you're unfamiliar with these, they're a little awkward at first. They're kind of cumbersome, they're repetitive, they're a little sing-songy. And so you can have the sense that you're listening to the oral tradition. And so these are texts that were memorized. And so they're basically sort of piles of lists because that's partly how memorization traditions work. So, here, bhikkhus. When a bhikkhu is giving attention to some sign, so meditating on something like the breath, And owing to that sign, there arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, with delusion. Then he should give attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome. When he gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. So, here you are practicing. You're tracking the breath, or you're moving through your day, trying to stay with a steady object of concentration. And something pulls your attention. Your mind gives attention to some sign, something. And when your mind gives attention to that thing, thoughts of grasping, aversion, or delusion, desire, hate, or ignorance, confusion, arise in you. And when that happens, this is method number one. You should give attention to some other sign that is wholesome, right? So basically, you have a distracting thought that is unwholesome or unskillful. It's based in desire, hatred, or delusion. The text says, notice it, and then think something else. That's what give attention to some other sign that is wholesome means. The commentaries flesh this out, and they say, if the distracting thought is oriented toward something that is based in desire, there are specific wholesome antidotes to that. If the desire is for a living thing, in other words, you're thinking about someone you're attracted to, the corresponding wholesome thought is, and remember, these are monastics, these are celibate monastics, so defeating lust is a primary discipline. The wholesome sign that you should give your attention to is the thought of I want to say this in non-judgmental language. The translation here is foulness, which is correct. It's asucha is the root. The unclean, the foul, the undesirable. Essentially, if you find yourself distracted by thinking of someone you're attracted to, think about how they are not actually that sexy, right? And the traditional way to think about this is to think like, oh, you think they have really beautiful hair. Well, imagine that hair, like, just kind of in a bowl, you know, like cut off of their head and just a pile of hair. It's like, oh, that's kind of not that interesting. It's like, oh, they have such lovely skin. It's like, well, imagine just all the skin taken off and just like all this is a pile of skin. It's like, oh, that's not all that sexy, you know. It's like, oh, but I love their shape. And you're like, well, just imagine it with, you know, all the organs laid out and the muscles laid out and the bones. And pretty soon, you see that the thing you were thinking of as like sexy is actually kind of a delusion of like, oh, if everything is just right, or like in A Streetcar Named Desire, like if the light is just right, then like, oh, then this one is really sexy. But if anything is different about that, you know, they have bad breath that day, they got a pimple, they're a teensy bit older than you prefer, or wrongly shaped, and then like, boom, it's over. And we start to see that the thing we think of as desirable is this like flimsy, strange kind of fog in the mind, which is a useful reminder if you're trying to be a celibate monk. We talked about this in a class a while back. If what you're actually trying to do is find a partner, it's maybe not so useful, because you might want to be like, well, I like that person. And you want to maintain the perception of them as sexy, because you're not a monastic, and that's fine. But if you're trying to meditate and you can't stop thinking about them, you still might want to think about something else. So the guidelines are this for replacing unwholesome thoughts with wholesome thoughts. If it's a thought of desire and it's toward a living person, replace it with the thought of foulness or imperfectness of them. If it's a thought of desire and it's for an inanimate object, like, you know, I really want your water bottle because it's nice, then the replacement wholesome thought is the thought of impermanence. Everything comes and goes, the water bottle will break, it's not actually going to give me lasting happiness because it's temporary. So you replace a thought of desire for the inanimate with the reflection on impermanence. If the thought is of hatred or aversion toward a living being, oh, I really don't like that person, the replacement thought is loving kindness, metta. If the aversion or hatred is toward a non-living thing, that water bottle is so offensive to me. Exactly. Then what's the replacement thought for the inanimate? The reflection on the elements. So if I dislike the thing, I can tune into its base material nature and essentially just do an inquiry into, like, its fundamental qualities. It's like, well, it's just manifesting the quality of earth and water and space. And really, there's not much to complain about when things are like that. And then if the distracting thought is based in delusion, if it's a thoughts connected with delusion aren't about objects because they're deluded, they're not as connected with objects. And so it says the remedy for thoughts connected with delusion is living under a teacher, studying the Dhamma, inquiring into its meaning, listening to the Dhamma, and inquiring into causes. So that's essentially like wisdom reflection. Just think about the teachings. So thoughts connected with delusion would be things like doubt. You know, sitting here being like, I wonder what's really true. Who am I? What's it all about? I don't know. What should I do in this life? It's all so mysterious. Like, that's a kind of deluded train of thought in this system. And the reflection would be, like, spend more time with your teacher and think about the Dhamma, you know, which is going to orient you. It's going to clarify that kind of foggy mind state. So those are the traditional antidotes here. But this first practice, I think the important thing to note about it is that it's not about, like, just stop thinking the thought or come back to the breath or something. It's actually replace the unskillful thought with a more skillful one. And so this is thought replacing thought. And it gives a simile, and I've used this simile in here before. It says, just as a skilled carpenter or his apprentice might knock out, remove, and extract a coarse peg by means of a fine one, so too, when a bhikkhu gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. So the idea is, here's this disturbing thought in one of these categories. I replace it with a wholesome thought. That essentially calms the energy of the thought. It takes away the grasping, the hatred, the aversion. And as that energy is calmed or met, both thoughts subside and the mind is brought to singleness and concentration. And that's the result for each of these antidotes, is that the mind gets concentrated after you apply it. So it's not like, oh, I had a mean thought about someone, so I do metta, and then I have to, like, keep doing metta for the next, like, hour of my sitting. It's more like I do some loving kindness until my system kind of resolves, and then I'm settled again, and then I return to stillness. All right, so that's method one. That's the gentlest of the methods. Yeah, they're going to get fiercer from here. Method number two is again in the direction of inquiry. If, while he is giving attention to some other sign connected with that, what is wholesome, there still arise in him evil and wholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate and delusion, then he should examine the danger in those thoughts. Thus, these thoughts are unwholesome. They result in suffering. So this one is, okay, it didn't work just to replace the unwholesome thought with the wholesome thought. I just kept thinking about the sexy person or the unpleasant water bottle or the confused sense of my life, and it just kept coming back. Then I look at the thought directly. I say, this is unwholesome. This doesn't serve the gathering of the mind, the purifying of the heart. This brings suffering, right? So, you know, I've totally had a sitting where, like, I'm just obsessing about some person, and I'm like, basically, I'm sort of thinking whatever the mind is thinking, some story is going on. But essentially, my mind is going, they're so good, they're so awesome, they're so sexy. Can't anything, really? And yeah, maybe? Like, that's kind of what the mind is doing. It's like, I like them so much. The reflection on that bringing suffering would be just to feel it and be like, I'm suffering. This is painful, right? Even if I'm going to, like, call them up right after the meditation and be like, yo, come out on a date with me, it's still painful. They might say no. They might say yes, and then it's a whole other can of worms. You end up married to people and having children, and it's so much suffering. So the reflection on the thought being danger is really, it points us right back to the noble truths. It's really like, what is suffering or distress? And it's like, oh, this thought, this grasping is just painful. And even when it's grasping towards something pleasurable, to really feel how, it's like, oh, that can't give me satisfaction. And so therefore, there's a danger in it. So you really reflect on the nature of the thought. And that reflection then, in a way, is like sobering, right? It kind of wakes me up out of the, like, oh, they're so sexy, or I really want that thing, or I'm like, oh, I really hate those people, or, you know, I'm so confused about that. It's like, oh, all of those things are not productive of deeper peace, deeper clarity, deeper concentration, deeper kindness. And again, it says, you know, when you reflect in that way, then the mind gets quiet. The simile with this one is kind of weird, but I'll read it to you. So here you are, you're examining, these thoughts are unwholesome, they are reprehensible, the text says they result in suffering. It says, just as, so here's what this is like, just as a man or woman, young, youthful, and fond of ornaments, would be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted if the carcass of a snake or a dog or a human being were hung around his or her neck. So too, when a bhikkhu examines the danger in those thoughts, his mind becomes steadied internally. So that's an odd one for me. But it feels, you know, it feels something like, okay, here I am, I'm young, I'm like, oh, I really like all my decorations, my fancy clothes, my beautiful necklaces, and all of my things. There's this way that I have this thing. I think it's something that it's not. Right? I think it's giving me this great satisfaction. And instead, it's just a thing hanging around my neck. And if the thing changed to, like, the carcass of a dog or human being, you know, it would be like, oh my God, you know, I would see how dreadful that is. So then I could see that about the ornaments themselves. That simile doesn't ring quite as purely for me. But again, it may have been an apt simile really for, like, the, you know, the celibate monastic crowd. So there you go. So method number two is to analyze the thoughts with discernment to see that they are productive of suffering, and based in that, let them go. Method number three. If, while he is examining the danger in those thoughts, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and delusion, then, this is method three, he should try to forget those thoughts and should not give attention to them. So you tried to replace your distracting thoughts with wholesome ones, that didn't work. You tried to reflect on how they are causing you suffering, that still didn't work. You're still just obsessively spinning with them. Then the text, in a very practical way, it says, just forget them. Just stop it. Ignore them. He tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Here's the simile. Just as a man with good eyes who did not want to see forms that had come within range of sight would either shut his eyes or look away, so too, when a bhikkhu tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. When I was a teenager, I was really sensitive, I think, to like shame and embarrassment as feelings, and which meant I really didn't like sitcoms. Because there was so often this moment, like the peak of the sitcom, and this was in the 80s, my sitcoms were like Growing Pains and Full House, and that was a little later. And these shows were, the plot very often hinged on like somebody kind of making a mistake, getting caught, being embarrassed or shamed in some way. And I remember actually there would always be this setup where like it's about to happen, you know, like he's at the party and he doesn't know that such and such is there and they're around the corner and they're about to see them and it's going to be like kind of embarrassing. And I would shut my eyes. I did this thing like, okay, it's not like I was empowered enough to leave the room or not watch, like we're all watching the sitcom in my family, but I would close my eyes. And I had this thing where, like, I just didn't want to see it, the moment where someone got, like, pie in their face, basically, emotionally. So that's maybe says something about my poor little system as a teenager. But this is this third kind of antidote, which is you don't look. You know, if you don't want the image from the horror movie to be burned into your mind forever, don't look at it. And so in this way, the thoughts come in, they're obsessive, replacing them didn't work, analyzing them didn't work, just don't look. And this takes some force of will. And this is where you can start to sense that the antidotes are getting a little more punchy. You know, it's not like if you could just like forget your anxious thoughts, like of course you would have done that a long time ago. It takes some force to do that. So at this point, you're starting to use some energy to be like, no. Like, no, I'm just not going to go down that route. And this takes a little more leaning in. And you have to be kind of awake to do this, to try to forget something. And I like that it says try to forget, because like, what does that even mean? How do you try to forget something? It seems kind of impossible. But there you go. It says it's like just closing your eyes and turning away when you don't want to see something. So what would that be like with a powerful thought? Method number four. If, while he is trying to forget these thoughts and is not giving attention to them, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should give attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts. This one's a little hard. One simple interpretation is just stop them and be like, stop, you thoughts. You know, just stop. And you can kind of like startle yourself into stilling. There's a Tibetan tradition that says you're meditating and things get a little swimmy and kind of a little less focused at a moment. And there's this syllable, this kind of peh syllable that you can shout to startle your mind into getting out of the train of thought. It's like, I was so lost. And you're just like, bah! And you're like, oh. You know? And there's a whole formal practice around that. The Zen one that I grew up with, or trained in initially, was Katz, K-A-T-Z. Lots of exclamation points. Katz! You would shout to kind of interrupt the stream. So just stopping the thoughts is this fourth forceful method. And there's some subtler details to the stilling the thought formations part. that talks about tracing the thought kind of back to its cause or its root cause. So and maybe this is not actually as obscure as it seems. One thing that you can do that's actually really interesting. I'll do this one sometimes when I'm just moving around town, and I find myself thinking about something, and I'm like, where did this come from? Why am I suddenly thinking about this? And I'll actually just trace it back, and I'll trace back my steps, and it'll be like, half a block back, I walked past this VW van, and inside the van on the windshield was a sticker of a white owl. And I thought about Harry Potter's white owl. And then now I'm thinking about the Harry himself being the seventh Horcrux. And I didn't know, like, why am I thinking about Harry Potter? And I had to trace it back and realize that it was the flash of that white owl sticker that had nothing to do with that triggered this chain of association. The chain of association is called papancha. Pali, it means proliferation of thought. And it's this thing that happens where one thought leads to another thought leads to another thought. And so tracing it back to the root cause can mean, if you have some mindfulness present, is that you can actually walk back through that train of thoughts. And sometimes it's long. It's like, oh, I was thinking about Harry Potter for a while. Oh, but that was because of the owl. But actually, no, it wasn't. Actually, the owl first made me think of this whole other thing. Like, there's a whole other loop in there. It's like, oh, I was thinking about this, I was thinking about that, and it wound around to this. And you can trace it all the way back, essentially, to the first sensory contact. And you'd be like, oh, and before that, I was actually just present with my breath and my body walking. And tracing it back to its root cause will be a way of interrupting the flow also. And then that teaches you something in this really cool way. And you're like, oh, right. That's how sensory stimulus works, actually. It's like you're cruising along, there's all the sensory stimulus, and then you see just something. And it pings your associative network, we would say, in OI. And when I was in music school, we had this game where we would put on a recording and then stop it instantly, and we would see who could guess what piece it was from only the first note. It was a name that tune, but it would just be like, bah, and someone would be like, Chopin's Second Sonata, Piano Sonata. And it was amazing, right? It's like, how do you do that? It's one note, but that was our game. But of course, how that also then works is, you're walking along somewhere and a door squeaks, but it squeaks in a little two-note pattern, and suddenly you're thinking about a song for the whole rest of your day because those two notes pinged that neural network. So this fourth method then is, again, it's an inquiry or a discernment method that says trace the thought back to its cause, usually in a sensory stimulus, and then also understand in a wisdom way how sensory stimulus is dangerous, right? Not meaning bad, but just meaning like, yeah, that's what happens when there's senses, is the mind, when it's untrained, and that's the main adjective used for suffering people in the text, is the ordinary untrained mind. The mind doesn't notice the association when it happens. It's not like I was walking along, purely mindful, and I saw the white owl, and I was like, oh, look, a white owl. That reminds me of Harry Potter. Done. Like, no, I lost it in that moment. It was interesting. I liked Harry Potter. And it was like, and there goes the mind. And then I catch it sometime later. And the only difference between the untrained mind and the trained mind is that you catch it sooner. So rather than wandering along for 20 minutes, meandering in some fantasy, you're just like, oh, look, image, association, let go, onward. Like, I don't need to think about that, basically, is the reflection. That's method four. The simile is about refinement. It's about actually going from a kind of grosser thing to a more refined thing. And this is a little bit the tracing back piece. Like, to notice that it was just the image of the white owl is a fairly refined noticing, whereas to be caught in the whole long narrative is a fairly gross level and much more mobile, as it were, noticing. So the simile is like this. Just as a man walking fast might consider, why am I walking fast? What if I walk slowly? And he would walk slowly. Then he might consider, why am I walking slowly? What if I stand? And he would stand. Then he might consider, why am I standing? What if I sit? And he would sit. Then he might consider, why am I sitting? What if I lie down? And he would lie down. By doing so, he would substitute for each grosser posture one that was subtler. So too, when a bhikkhu gives attention to stilling the thought formation of these thoughts, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. I like this simile so much, and use it in some different ways, but it's lovely that it describes the person's thought process. Why am I walking fast? Like, why not just walk slower? But why am I even walking at all? Why just stand here? Well, why am I still standing? What if I just sit down? Like, it's like, why am I expending more effort when I could do an easier thing? And the person ends up just lying down as the subtlest and easiest of the postures. This is good meditation practice for many of us. Why am I working so hard? What if I worked less? Why am I still sitting up? What if I just chilled out? Take it all the way down. Okay, the last one. And this is the one that gets bad press in Western Buddhism, and no one ever teaches on it. So here you go. If, while he's giving attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts, there still arise in him evil and unwholesome thoughts, connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then, and this is the last option, just to say, right? Then, with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he should beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. He should beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. Whoa, I know. We never do this one, really. But if you practice for long enough, you will have moments where this is a useful tool. You can't use it every day. It loses its force, right? You just get tired. But there is a moment when, when it's just appropriate to just be like, no, and really mean it with all your force. And it's like, it's like, okay, teeth clenched, tongue pressed against the roof of the mouth. Totally, as a footnote, tongue at the roof of the mouth is an interesting energetic maneuver also that shows up throughout the yogic and pranayama worlds. That's a curious one that it's in here. Teeth clenched, tongue pressed against the roof of the mouth. He beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind. Just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him, and crush him, so too, when, with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, a bhikkhu beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. So the sequence here, very interestingly, when we learn concentration practice in most of the Western traditions that I've been in, the practice is mostly about really trying to stay with a single object, like the breath, and doing whatever you can to kind of dismiss distraction and stay with it. Here, all of these practices are actually quite active. The gentlest one is actually just more thinking. It's just better thinking. So the sequence is replace unwholesome thoughts with wholesome ones, or reflect on the danger of the unwholesome thoughts, so bring in wisdom, or just forget them, don't pay attention to them, or trace them back to their origin as a way to let them go. And if none of that works, just crush them with your mind. And one of the things that I like about this text, and is really interesting to me given how I was trained, which you know, in standard Vipassana training, I was taught none of these, actually. Right? Replacing thoughts with an antidote, very rarely taught. Occasionally, it would be like, well, bring in some metta, would be the only one really that ever gets mentioned. But, you know, nothing about like how to actually work with, in a wisdom way, grasping thoughts, angry thoughts, deluded thoughts. It was always just name them, come back, name them, come back. This is a consequence of modernist Burmese Vipassana. This wasn't emphasized. So really reflecting, these wholesome reflections. And then the different kinds of analysis, analyzing the danger in thoughts. It's implied in the way that we study the Noble Truths, but it wasn't taught as a thing to do in meditation. Forget them was probably the closest to the method that I was taught, which was really just like, acknowledge them, come back. Like, just don't give them any attention. That third method, probably the most common one in my training. The fourth one, trace them back to their origin. I actually like that one a lot. And again, I wasn't trained in it. I discovered it at some point. Somebody mentioned an aspect of it, and I was like, oh, that's really actually a beautiful practice, and it's quite lovely actually to find that you can do that, and just to say that that's the practice that, when strengthened an absurd amount, leads to remembering your past lives, is that you walk back mind moment to mind moment, remembering like each thought that preceded that thought, and you go back through your whole life to the moment where your consciousness flipped into this body. Just saying, that's what they say. He does. So here's the end of this of the sutta. And I was never taught to beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. But like I said, we all kind of figure that one out eventually. Like there's eventually a moment when you're so frustrated with your mind, you're just like, fucking shut up. Sorry, but you know, and like be nice to yourself. But you know, I don't really discipline my toddler, but I make all sorts of boundaries, and I make the gentlest boundary I can, and then when it needs to be firmer, I make it firmer. When it needs to be firmer, I make it firmer. But you know, there's a few moments when something stronger is necessary. There was a moment when we were with our Sarah's brother, so our nieces, our nephews, and one, they were like 3 or 4 or whatever. We were in Japantown in San Francisco, and one of them ran out the door of a shop, saw his parents across the street, and just ran between 2 parked cars straight toward his parents. And my partner Sarah was with him, and saw him, this little kid, just like running straight into traffic because he couldn't see anything. And she just screamed, "Stop!" And he stopped and he started crying. But it's like, that's the moment. There's not that many moments like that, you know, and you don't need to use that voice until you need it. But that was this fifth intervention. It's like, stop, you mind. So the sutta ends like this. Once you do all of these things. This bhikkhu, the one whose mind has become steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. This bhikkhu is then called a master of the courses of thought. He will think whatever thought he wishes to think, and he will not think any thought that he does not wish to think. He has severed craving, flung off the fetters, and with the complete penetration of conceit, he has made an end of suffering. So that line is an ancient way of saying, this is the doorway to full liberation. That you will think whatever you want to think, and you won't think anything you don't want to think. And then, with the complete penetration of conceit, so really seeing through the fixated self is what this leads to, you'll make an end of suffering. And the text ends the way many of these texts end. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. But in many of the texts, it says, you know, upon hearing this discourse, you know, 500 bhikkhus were spontaneously awakened. And this text does not say that. So this isn't a text where anyone got suddenly awakened, which is appropriate. It's not actually a wisdom text. It's not telling you how things are. It's telling you what to do. So ideally, right, those bhikkhus like went back to their huts in the forest and did this. This is really a like practice advice text. So what do you think? Any thoughts? Should we practice beating down, constraining, and crushing the mind next week for Christmas? Thoughts or questions on this? Yeah.
Well, it's interesting for me because I only really know like the yoga tradition or the Kashmir Shaivism tradition, which uses the witness as a way of not identifying with the mind or the thoughts, but it appears in this to actually use the mind to still the mind.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if it feels like there's a missing piece of the grace or the self or the, I mean, what gives a seeker the capacity or the enthusiasm to do these practices mm-hmm. without? So I don't.
Yep.
I don't.
It's true. This is a much earlier tradition than those, and so certainly the things that are prominent in that tradition, like the presence of grace, or you know, the role of the guru at all, you know, and the deities, etc. But even as you're saying, the really focusing on the witness or the witness self, all as a way to gather and channel the energy you need to refine your attention and come to settledness. Those concepts don't develop for a millennium or so after this. And so this is still, I think, a very almost mundane practice in a certain way, mm-hmm. Where it's just you and your will, you know. And in terms of like what gives a practitioner the basis or the energy to do a practice like this, you know. Some of the implications here are, you know, first of all, that this is a talk for monks. It's not a talk for like random lay people coming. So these are people who have already devoted their whole lives to the practice. They have given up everything. They've taken refuge, right? They've accepted the view system that they're under. There's so many things that are already in place if you're a monastic in the system. And so those things, in a way, would be some of that foundation that you're speaking to. That would support someone to do this practice. You know, and we can remember that in the early system, if he's talking about meditation at all, he's not talking to us, actually. He's not talking to lay people. It's monks and nuns that are meditating. Lay people's practice in the earliest system really consisted of generosity, ethics, taking care of the family, taking care of the monastics. You know, like maintaining a wholesome and well-ordered society, really. But meditation wasn't their primary thing. And that grew as the tradition matured, and it became clear that lay people could also meditate and gain great benefit, you know, from it. But the emphasis in many of these early texts is that the contemplative or liberation practices were kind of the province of the monastics. So then there would be the whole structure of monastic life supporting the, you know, right. Doing this.
Yeah. But there's the assumption that you can get there through thought. inherent in the text.
Well, that's part of what's really interesting about this, isn't it? It's this one says, very curiously, here's these five things that all take some kind of thought,
right?
But each one of them, even the ones that are all thought, like replace the unwholesome thought with wholesome thoughts, it still says the mind will be steadied, brought to singleness, meaning not thinking, quieted internally.
Right.
So it's a little bit like you use thought to come to the end of thought in this particular little layout.
Yeah.
That is different, for instance, from some of the later non-dual traditions that you've been exposed to, that in a sense would bypass this whole realm altogether and just be like, that's just more fluctuating energy.
Mm-hmm.
Simply identify with the one who is always present. And all of that is just ornamentation in some way, mm-hmm. you know. But in this system, it's very concentration-oriented. It's very much like, you know, use the mind. Use the thinking mind to come to the end of distraction and thoughts. Yeah?
It seemed very advanced. This system presumes a level of metacognition, the ability to actually see your thoughts.
It does.
So it's like most of the time, I'm not really aware of what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
It's all trigger. It's all reaction.
Yeah. Right. The quality that underlies even being able to do any of these is mindfulness.
Right.
Right. You have to be mindful enough to be like, oh, look, I'm having a thought of desire based on that.
Exactly.
You know, it's like, that's fairly advanced.
That's what
right.
I
You're right.
That's what I was saying to me. Like, I was just, oh, can I sit there? Even the Vipassana, oh, you know, thinking, oh, pain, it might be, oh, I'm thinking about work or whatever. To know that, even to have that
absolutely
witnessing of the thought is a high level of practice.
It is.
But then when we were talking, I'm thinking, you know, these guys were living in nature.
Yeah. Yeah.
They had no screens. Nothing was like distracting them constantly, like we're constantly distracted in modern life.
Yeah, you're living in a hut, you know, the forest. Once a day you walk through a small town.
That's
the only thing happening, man.
Nothing
totally.
To think about to look at.
Totally. No, I think, you know, there's no way for us to know how. I mean, this is just, such a mysterious question. Can we have any sense of what the mind state of a pre-modern person was like?
Mm-hmm.
We have a sense of, like, what they ate, how they lived, all that stuff that we have from kind of archaeological record. But mind state, mm-hmm. one of the things that's amazing about these texts is that we actually get descriptions of mind states, mm-hmm. you know. When the Buddha says, you know, having abandoned this and abandoned that and found, you know, the release from this, I live in the woods, separate, quieted, blissful, with a mind like a wild deer. And I read that, I'm like, really? And like, almost just like, to do the little exercise of taking it seriously, to be like, he lives in the woods with a mind like a wild deer. This isn't like some transcendent, I left the body and I'm in some cosmic enlightened space. He becomes like an animal. Like kind of one the peaceful animals at that. It's like, oh, you just hang out grazing? You know? So that's kind of amazing that we get these descriptions of like, I don't know hardly anybody like that, really. You know, a couple backwoods hippies and they have other pathways to get there. But, you know, yeah, right? So it's true.
My second thought was the third one or whatever was the following the thought back.
Yeah.
To me resembled some of my psychotherapy.
Yeah, totally.
What was the trigger that made me want to kill?
Yeah.
I'm suddenly thinking this like, I'm so angry or whatever.
Yeah.
Remind me of my mother who talked to me this way. My sister did that all the way back to when I was a baby.
Sure, sure.
You know, so that following the train of line of thoughts all the way back, it's like this sort of slowing down the movie.
Yeah.
of my life that was that sort of zoomed in fast motion from some early trauma
right.
to the present moment
right.
in one split second.
It's very it's very psychodynamic, actually, that fourth one, really, because, you know, it's like, yeah, it's a prosaic example to say, like, oh, I traced back the thought of Harry Potter to, like, seeing a sticker of a white owl. I just made it up. I don't know. Something. But of course, what very often happens is, like, you know, I'm grumpy about this thing that's happening at work because I had this conversation, because I was triggered in this way, because I always get triggered in this way because of my growing up, my family, my mother, my father. Something happened. I was hurt in this way. I was attacked in this way. Like, oh, actually, this is trauma processing. To trace something right. back like that and be like, that's the root. So,
and that's where you get into the past lives and the ancestors passing on their trauma.
For sure, for sure, for sure. All of that is embedded in that one. Any other thoughts here for you? Yeah, Ty.
Thank you, Sean.
Yeah.
I have actually a question about negative image.
Yeah.
That is staying with you for a while.
Yeah.
I got to see some horrible movies.
Yeah.
2 years ago,
yeah,
and the image is still staying with me.
I know, I have them too.
Mm-hmm. And it was, it was kind of, it was not really like just plain killing, it was
terrible. Yeah, yeah.
It was not good.
Yeah.
You know, that image is kind of got photographed in my mind,
yeah.
and sometimes I have obsessive thoughts,
yeah.
and it's very disturbing.
Yeah.
Like, I cannot stop thinking about it, and then, like,
yeah.
sometimes I'm catching myself kind of participating into that.
Sure.
Even though
sure.
I don't want to react on it, I kind of find myself getting carried away with those thoughts and being part of it. So, once I tried to use a technique where I just kind of sit with those negative thoughts and try to go through them.
Yeah.
Because there is nothing else I can do.
Yeah.
It's just like, it already
happened. Okay, play it through, right.
But I was wondering if there are any other techniques that kind of help with that, because it's just sometimes so disturbing that I'm still thinking
yeah.
about it.
Those images are, sometimes I think about those kinds of movies now, like really they're horrific movies that embed very, very violent or terrible images in our, and of course, like movies, like some of us, you know, may have spent time in a real war zone and actually seen horrific violence, real live violence, and of course, we call that traumatizing for a reason, you know, to witness that in reality. But I think the mind has a related trauma response even when we know it's fiction. Some of those images are so horrid. And I have some of them myself, burned in from, you know, I grew up in the 80s, like I grew up in the era of slasher movies, and like, they're in there. And so, yeah, and they will never really go away. Like, they're part of our image consciousness now. But some of these techniques, in a certain way, could work exactly the same way. So one would be like, replace the image with a wholesome image. So like, think about a different image, like really bring to mind, you know, a beautiful meadow or your house or your pet or someone you love, you know, just like replace the image and really see it, concentrate on it. Another would be to just replace it with a blank image. I used to visualize a massive kind of whitish gray wall with no ornaments on it, like just a big color field, and I would concentrate on that color field and it would shift the inner image. The one that you did was kind of the tracing it back, like actually go through it, be like, this is this image, and it's in it. You know, or like reflecting on how painful it is. All that would be one of these. And the one that nowadays just feels most right to me is that we do a lot in here, is really just visual orientation. In other words, like, oh, that's an imagined image. Open my eyes and come into contact with where I am. Like, what am I seeing? It's like, well, there's that funny red, like, fairy fancy bed over there. I don't know what that thing is. It's very odd. And then they're like, oh, there's a pink flower on the Buddha, and there's candle flames, and there's the red wall. You know, like, just like get out of the image channel into the present moment image channel. But for all of these, essentially, you're substituting a better image for the terrible image. The other one that is in here that I do really respect and do, especially with stuff like that, is I try to actually just feel how painful it is. Not just that it's frightening or gross or terrible, but actually just that, like, having this image in my consciousness is just painful, right? That there's a kind of hatefulness in the image itself. Like, oh, we had to make images of, like, tearing up bodies. Why? Right? But that there's... I can just feel the pain of that. And I'll be like, oh, this is just pure human suffering. First of all, that this kind of action actually exists in the world is horrific. And then that we would need to... that we would fictionalize it in these ways and kind of sensationalize it and pornographize it, like make it attractive, is also just painful. So sometimes I'll be like, okay, there you are, terrible image. Like, can I actually feel how much it hurts? And that would be part of this realm as well. Yeah. Cool. All right, so do things with your distracting thoughts. I think next week we'll continue in looking at the kind of some of the technical details in meditation. We may swing back to emotions. I'll feel into kind of what would serve us as we do this. And if you have particular things you're interested in, let me know, and we'll talk on them. Kind of building up kind of some of the basics of what we actually do when we sit. So thanks for coming on a dark solstice-y week.
Oh, solstice
tonight. Wednesday, Thursday.
Oh,
tomorrow
Wednesday,
night.
Thursday.
Yeah. But yeah, short days, long nights. Enjoy the long winter nights. And happy holidays if you do any of those various holidays that are all around now. And I'll be here next week, day after Christmas. So, blessings.